Hey everyone, welcome back to the 443 Security Simplified. I'm your host, Mark the Liberty, and joining me today is...
This is going to be a stupid one, but I am Corey Ballgood and Knockreiner. It's going to make no sense. Even when you learn the story I'm referring to, you'll have to think about how it makes any sense at all.
I don't want to know how that, like, alliteration was built either. But Ballgood anyways... And... on today's episode, we'll be discussing Bat Bad Butt.
There you go.
The vulnerabilities in popular programming languages on Windows operating system. Before that, we'll talk about hacking Corey's TV, and we will end with a bit of research from our friends at Chex Marks, on how threat actors are leveraging GitHub to deliver malicious code to poor little gamer nerds like us everywhere.
You should probably crunch on in, Mark. If I check,
that's next. A good one. Let's go ahead and crunch our way in. So let's start today with the first story, which this one, when I saw the headlines, Corey, didn't we have a prediction on this topic, I guess? I feel like we did. Maybe we didn't. Anyways, when I saw this headline, my first thought was like, oh, okay, yeah, no duh. That was bound to happen at some point. But anyways, without further edging to the actual news story, Bitdefender disclosed a series of vulnerabilities in some LG TV models just last week that could allow attackers to effectively root the device and take full control if they had network access. If you're not a LG TV owner, they run on a Linux-based operating system called WebOS, and their operating system exposes two network services on ports 3000 and 3001. Thank you, macOS, stupid little notification things, and great.
And good balloons for the YouTube viewers. They'll enjoy those.
Exactly. So it exposes these services specifically so that if you've got the LG ThinQ app on your smartphone, you can control your TV with it like a remote. Now, as long as you are.
By the way, I'm glad we're not talking about TVs like the one, if you can see YouTube right there. Actually, I've already checked. It's not one of the models, but LG OLEDs are my favorite. And there are some OLEDs affected. And WebOS, man. Anyways, keep going.
Yeah. So there's four vulnerabilities that they went through. And you can chain basically the first one and any of the other ones together in order to gain code execution on the TVs as long as you have network access to them. So the first vulnerability, I guess to lay the framework for this one, in order to use that functionality from your smartphone to connect to the TV, you first need to register your app to the TV. And you do that through the app. It calls a API function on the TV, and then it prompts you to enter in a PIN code that's displayed on the TV itself to at least prove that you're like physically in the same room with the TV. Once you've successfully entered that PIN code, it creates what's called a companion client key and saves that back to the app. And from then on out, anytime your app interacts with the TV, it sends that companion client key to the TV as the authentication of it saying it is who it is. So the API that's exposed in here, all the requests, they've got a parameter behind the scenes that gets flagged under certain circumstances called skip prompt, which bypasses that PIN code requirement when interacting with it. So for example, when that companion client key parameter is sent, all requests have that skip prompt flag set because your phone is already registered. It already has a client secret that it's sending to the TV. You don't need to enter a PIN code every single time you want to increase or decrease the volume on the TV, for example. There's also some types of unprivileged requests where a PIN code is not required and that skip prompt flag is set there too. So for example, if you register a device and create an account that has zero permissions at all, it actually sets that flag. So you don't need to enter in a PIN code in order to do that. So Bitdefender found that they could create an account with no permissions, which does not require setting that PIN, which then generates that companion client key for their permissionless account and sends it back to them. They then found they could issue another request to create another account with elevated permissions, but then pass that companion client key parameter with the request. And the TV would see the parameter and go, oh, okay, look, they're already authenticated. They'd set that skip prompt flag and create that account with full permissions without prompting for the PIN. So long story short, if you have network access to the TV, you can create arbitrary full administrator accounts within the web OS operating system at this point. So we're not talking about the Linux like underlying thing. This is a user that can now interact with any API parameter. Oopsie indeed. The next one though, so the CVE-2023-6318. So the operating system has a built-in function for processing like analytic reports behind the scenes. One of the parameters in this function is passed directly to a system command without being sanitized. And on the face of it, this wouldn't necessarily, I mean, that's never a good practice in programming. It should never happen. It is a vulnerability. But on the face of it, it doesn't look like an exploitable vulnerability because that function isn't actually directly exposed to the API. I mean, you can't just send a web request to the TV, call this function, pass in your unsanitized input, and gain code execution. So Bitdefender actually got pretty creative, and they found a way to effectively do what's called a server-side request forgery attack, basically tricking the web server in this operating system into making its own request, which it can access any function that's available to it. So specifically, the API has a function called write notification toast, or the permission called write notification toast, which gives the user permissions to call a function to basically trigger an alert on the TV. Like maybe it would say, I don't know, your phone has been disconnected or something like that. This function to create the alert has, in programming terms, what's called a callback function. Basically, after it executes, it can call another function kind of in a chain. Usually programmers will use that to like take whatever the results of the first one were, pass it to something else to like log or maybe do another function that required that first one to complete, whatever. So Bitdefender found, though, they could set that onClose callback parameter to that process analytics report function earlier to trigger it. Now, that was the first step. There was another limitation they had to exploiting this, where that process analytics report function only accepts files that are like actually located on the storage device of this TV. So you would have to somehow get your carefully crafted malicious file onto this TV to get it picked up by this function to let you gain that code execution. Well, they found that there's another one that's exposed to the API, or actually not to the API, that's just callable using this server-side request forgery attack that lets them download whatever the heck they want to the TV. There's like a actual download function where they can go grab a random file off the internet, save it locally, and now use their little process analytics report function to trigger that code execution on the TV. So another oopsie. The second vulnerability leveraged the same kind of chain to get to where it was. It needed that server-side request forgery one they found. But they found another function called get audio metadata that takes in audio files and, as you might guess, tries to get the metadata out of that file. They found that if you pass a file with an MP3 extension, it would take some of the parameters from the metadata located within that file and, again, pass it to a system command, so executed on the underlying operating system without sanitizing it.
An LRC file, by the way, is just a lyric file. So I found this part a little novel. It's not the first time this tight light. Like, I've also seen other media vulnerabilities where, say, for video, a .srt file, which is for subtitles, some way that SRT file was parsed could help with a code execution. So this was interesting, and I know lyrics aren't quite the same as subtitles, but it's the same type of some sort of file parsing thing that was interesting to me.
Both of these so far, you take the first vulnerability to let you interact with the API, and you take either of these two to execute arbitrary code in the operating system. But so far, this code is executed as the like web server user, which doesn't have a full suite of permissions to like escape out of many different areas on the TV. The fourth and final vulnerability they found, though, was a final function called set VLAN static address, which, as you might guess, is used to set a static IP address on a network VLAN. There's a bit of a setup you had to do. You had to actually create a virtual interface first, which was an easy enough thing to do through the API. But then when you call this function, it passes two of the IP address related parameters to a system command without being sanitized. And in this case, the user that executes these commands is called dbus, which it's not the root user, but it basically has the same set of permissions as the root user. And so this was the way to gain like root system level code execution on this TV by just having network access to these exposed ports. Now, you might think, you know, this is a TV. It's sitting in Corey's living room right behind them. Like, how could anyone potentially exploit this? Well, if you look up the screenshot Corey's showing, a search on Shodan.io, the search engine for exposed devices, there are currently just over 90,000 LG WebOS TVs with those ports exposed directly to the internet.
That's a few of them. That's a few of them. I will say, your jokes aside, by the way, they have some TV models in one of the reports. I guess this is not the one. Maybe it's the Ars Technica one. That are vulnerable to this, and mine was not on the list. More importantly, as you were talking about the one vulnerability where, you know, some of the functions they were using is after a notification, they would pop up something. The pop-up I get most often, Mark, is since I have auto updates on my TV, I get a pop-up that says your TV has been updated. So I think I might be okay.
And most importantly, I hope your TV is not directly on the internet.
No, it's actually segmented and is not exposed at all.
How does a TV like this end up directly on the internet? Because like, you're either intentionally forwarding these ports to it.
I wonder, is there any PNP capability? Because I definitely have it network connected so it can go out. I obviously have not set up any port forwards to it, but I haven't looked at the latest updates to plug and play. And I know that some routers are able to interact with plug and play things where they might establish open ports for devices that are saying, hey, I want to. So I don't know, but when I scan my external network, I certainly don't see my LG TV.
Yeah, I sure hope not.
Or should I say TVs? This is buzz marketing for LG. I should get commission because I have like three of their OLEDs now. I use one for a computer monitor. They should pay me. Although maybe I should change my mind after vulnerabilities like this one.
The wealth gap is real, people.
Hey, they've dropped quite a bit in price. They're actually not as cray. I feel a little mad because I can get the very expensive one on my wall for half the price now.
But I do agree, their panels are pretty great, but apparently their operating system leaves a little to be desired.
That's the saddest thing, because that smart TV is the least thing. I have my own Apple TV and HTPC, so I don't need smart TV OSs. And 99% of the time, they're Linux bloatware. They're full of crap in ads. And so the WebOS part of the TV is my least favorite part. They could get rid of that. And by the way, they're hardening their Linux-based. And this is not just LG, by the way. All these TVs tend to use the Android OS for their Linux-based TV. This is why they have these vulnerabilities, in my opinion. They're not doing a great job.
The good news is, if you wanted to get rid of WebOS, you would just need a vulnerable TV. You could exploit this chain of vulnerabilities, gain root, and remove whatever the heck you want off of it.
Someone needs to release a jailbreak that debloats your TV.
We joke, but this is also, it's still a pretty serious issue, because I can't imagine, like, if someone were to pop one of these TVs and gain root and gain persistence on it, which would be trivial once you have that, there's like setting up a Linux service to continuously beacon to a command and control server. Like, how the heck would the typical person ever know this or spot it or resolve it?
Yeah. But Mark, it's just the TV. Who cares if they mess with the screen? I don't get the people that don't worry about like a Linux refrigerator or TV or, you know, speaker, whatever, audio device. It matters. This becomes a bastion host on your network. They don't really care that it's a TV. By they, I mean the threat actors, but this is a Linux subsystem. that once they have that root, they can, for all I know, I don't know how much space is on my TV, but they could probably load some Linux packages with that level of access and start using your TV to secretly be the bastion host scanning the rest of your network. So I agree with you. It's serious. And that's the biggest problem with IoT Floss is some people, depending on the IoT device, discount it because they're like, oh, if my video-based bird feeder gets hijacked, who cares? It just means I can't see birds until I fix it. But I think they forget the power of having any device inside your network. And if it's Linux-based, it does way more than you, it can do way more than you think. And to your point, it's a bird feeder, it's a TV, it's a microwave, refrigerator, whatever else they're putting computers in nowadays. It's just this hidden device that no one is thinking could be packet sniffing your network or scanning your network or exploiting other devices. So it is kind of scary, Mark. You're right.
So I guess if you are an owner of one of these affected TVs, the first thing you should do is exploit the vulnerabilities yourselves and then use that to install WatchGuard EPDR on your TV and potentially catch some of these threats that might be targeting.
There is a Linux version, right? And as modders and jailbreakers for good guy reasons, not bad guy reasons, I actually like the idea of jailbreaking my TV to fix it.
That said, I'm willing to bet that it's a little bit fragile in terms of messing around with applications running on the operating system, and I would hate to brick your stupid expensive OLED TV by a EPDR.
And I do want their Technicolor updates too. I don't want to break the auto updates because it does make a pretty picture, and LG is pretty good at making it better and better as they can. Give me the new codecs.
In terms of timeline on this one, so Bitdefender actually reported these issues to LG last year, I believe in November of last year. And it took until around March 22nd of this year to get the patch at least released. And Bitdefender gave them another couple of weeks for users to hopefully uptake on the patch before publishing their advisory. I have to, as a consumer device, even though it's been a couple of weeks since the patch has been out, some of these are going to sit around for quite some time without ever getting that update.
For sure.
So,
although practical takeaway, LG TVs with webOS does have auto update. I can't remember if it was the default, Mark, but I turn it on every device I can that's an IoT device. So while normal people might forget manual updates to things like TVs, just turn on auto update and hopefully you'll be fine when it patches. When it's patched properly.
When it is patched. So moving on, next story is a research blog post from at least hacker handle known as Ryota K from Flat Security Inc. about how a bunch of popular programming languages handle sanitizing parameters before passing them to the Windows create process function. And he gave this vulnerability or series of vulnerabilities a name called Bat Bad Butt. And there was a little quote from his research post explaining it. He goes, "While I'm not a fan of naming vulnerabilities that are not internet breaking, I am a fan of puns. So I decided to call this vulnerability Bat Bad Butt because it's about batch files and bad, but not the worst."
I like that he has a reason for it. I got to say, it's a hard one to say, even if you giggle at the reason. Bat Bad Butt. Say that three times fast. I think that's something actors can use to do their enunciation drills right before going on TV or something.
Yep. Anyways, so for the vulnerability or series of vulnerabilities themselves, there's a bit of setup for this. So most programming languages support some way to execute like other applications or scripts or batch files on the operating system. So for example, in Node.js, there's the child process package that has a function called spawn. In Python, it's subprocess run. Most programming languages have something like this. And these language-specific wrappers basically take that Windows create process function and make it easier for developers to interact with it. Like, so for example, in the Node.js spawn function, it accepts a couple parameters. The first parameter is the command to execute, like echo or ping or something like that. And then the second parameter is a list of just strings that it will go ahead and take care of sanitizing, wrapping in quotes, and then passing to that command as arguments securely, in theory. That sanitization helps untrusted input or helps handle untrusted input by preventing someone from adding their own quotes to parameters to escape out. So for example, let's say you run a command for like echo and then pass two words, hello world. The spawn function would wrap those words in double quotes so that the echo command would print out the two words, hello world. Without sanitization, if I controlled the input for those arguments, literally the words hello world, I could put a double quotation character in the middle of those words, and echo would just print out the word hello, and then it would try and execute the word world as a command because it's outside of those double quotes because I've terminated early inside my string there.
Different example completely, but just as a kind of metaphorical example, you and I have often tried to show generically how SQL injection is done. And when you get to the point where you're injecting, often the first thing you inject is something like a semicolon, and you're doing the same thing, or you inject a single quote, and you're doing the same thing. You're either trying to cut off a string before it was intended so that you can take over, and the semicolon is then to get you to the next command line. So a lot of injection vulnerabilities, whether they're, you know, ones here in this create process function, or if they're ones in web application languages, the first thing you're trying to do is find a way to get out of the real legit code, you know, that's happening early so that you can start taking over what the code is. So I like that whole double quote example. I'm showing a video of a similar thing, but it doesn't use two words and doesn't show yet how you inject the double quote.
Yeah. And so most programming languages, they take care of that sanitization for you for like this specific function right here. They'll escape those double quotes by inserting backslashes. So they search through the string anywhere they see a double quote, they put a backslash in front of it so that when they put it into their fully formed command and pass it to the create process, it's a string that may contain escape backslashes in it instead of actually escaping and allowing you to gain that arbitrary execution. So it turns out the create process function from Windows actually has a couple of quirks in it that cause these issues that this researcher found. So for example, typically when you call the create process function in Windows, it will take care of executing the command that you gave it just on its own. But in a certain circumstance, when your command is a batch file, so something ending in .bat or .cmd, it actually can't execute these files on its own directly. And so under the hood, it launches command.exe and then passes that command to execute as a parameter to command.exe. And the underlying issue for these vulnerabilities is that command.exe does not use the same escape characters as create process does on its own. So create process recognizes a backslash as an escape character. Command.exe uses a caret instead. So the little like upwards triangle thing. And so what this means is, anyone with the ability to control the parameters that are passed, the arguments that are passed, to a call to this create process function for a batch file can escape their parameters and effectively run any arbitrary command on the underlying operating system through this program. Now, in order for an application to be vulnerable to this or to be affected, it needs to first run on Windows, and it needs to execute commands with user-supplied arguments that are ultimately executed with a batch script file. So it's a pretty narrow scope, I would argue. But in the world of programming, where like all these languages are used all the time to create thousands of programs a day, like there's a non-zero number of vulnerable applications of these, I think, that we'd potentially run into in the wild. And it does affect nearly all programming languages. The author of this research article put out a response saying, so far, Rust issued a patch to improve how they sanitize these parameters passed to that function. And they even throw an error now if they cannot properly sanitize an argument instead of just executing it and allowing it to escape. Similar, Node.js and PHP as well, but other programming languages like Python, Ruby, Erlang, and Go, have instead just updated their documentation to call out this edge case as a scenario. Corey?
No, I was looking at something else on the
article. So either way, it feels like it's a serious issue because being able to inject arbitrary commands into any program where you can control those inputs is a pretty big deal. But like the scope is pretty narrow, and I don't think in terms of like practical impact, this will be world breaking.
Yeah, that's the but after the bad.
Exactly. So moving on to the final story today. So researchers at Checksmarks published, I guess, pausing for a second before we get into this. I think this is the second story we've had from Checksmarks in the last like month or so. And every time I see their name, I first read it as Chexmix and almost stumble on it every single time.
Everyone likes to make a good Chexmix-based GURP or whatever.
Exactly. So anyways, researchers at Chexmix published a research article describing new tactics that attackers are leveraging to trick developers into interacting with malicious GitHub repositories. So in this real-world scenario that they've identified in a few cases, attackers will first set up a malicious GitHub repository that's disguised to look like a legitimate project. And they're typically targeting like popular games or cheats for popular games or popular tools used by developers. And then they leverage a few of these new tactics to trick victims into downloading this malicious copy of whatever this tool is instead of the actual legitimate one that exists somewhere else on GitHub. So first, they use GitHub Actions, which is a way to like automate part of your development and build process within GitHub. They use GitHub Actions to automatically update their repositories at a pretty high frequency, usually by modifying a single file, like a log file, and either adding random garbage to it or incrementing a date or something. And this artificially boosts their repository visibility within GitHub search. And especially if the user filters their results by most recently updated, by nature of theirs being updated on a regular quick interval, it should almost always appear at that top of that list. Additionally, they've been using fake accounts to add stars, which is like GitHub's equivalent of like a like, to their repositories, to give this illusion of popularity and trustworthiness. And this also boosts them in GitHub searches, especially when a user filters by most starred applications. And so Checksmarks actually points out this isn't a new thing. Like malicious repositories have done this in the past, but typically they'd go like way overboard and give their projects like 1,000 stars, which in real world niche applications like this typically isn't reality, and that can raise suspicion. In this new scenario, they're finding the attackers are only adding a handful or a couple dozen stars to their applications just to give it enough credibility, like in comparison to the other applications in this niche space, to make it seem like it is the legitimate one that the victim would want to download.
Of course, your friend 93. So if your friend 93 has a lot of stars, you can guarantee they're your friend.
They pointed out all the some of the accounts that were being used. And one of the big red flags is that almost all of them were created on the exact same day, which is if you have 20 accounts with randomized usernames all created on the same day starring a project, that's would raise my suspicions. Yep. So when it comes to the malware itself, though, that the attackers are injecting, so they found they were hiding it in Visual Studio project files, so files with the extension vcxproj or csproj. They were leveraging obfuscated code that automatically executes during the build process for these files. So you can think of these as like configuration and automation files within Visual Studio as a development environment, where maybe you have a pre-build script that runs to go and grab other artifacts you need in there or set up the tool chain, or a post-build function that runs to upload it to an artifact repository or something. Those files you can include in a GitHub repository, and because of the power of build pipelines like that, they can ultimately execute arbitrary commands like this.
So, by the way, just because some of the sample that this is, people might remember our PyPy Valorant related stuff last week. By the way, maybe that's the checks mix stuff you were referring to, and which was also using GitHub. Is this at all related to that story, Mark?
It does not seem directly related, but the reason that checks mix, I'm assuming they're the cheesy edition and not the bold and spicy, but the reason checks mix is writing about it is they are a source code / open source analysis vendor. And so they do a lot of work in GitHub and spot a lot of these campaigns going on. Corey, what's your favorite type of checks mix? I said cheesy because that's my favorite, the cheddar one.
I probably would go with the bold one. I mean, cheese is always good. I'm a cheese fan, but you know I like spicy crap. So the bold one sounded pretty good to me. But I, to be honest, my current diet is more protein than Chex Mix.
Okay. Anyways, back to the actual attack. So the malware that hides within these Visual Studio project files, it first runs a batch script that sets up an environment for the attacker. And then it executes a VBS script, a Visual Basic script file, that pulls out a encoded PowerShell command out of itself and executes that PowerShell command. PowerShell then retrieves the country code of the machine's IP address, so it geolocates to figure out where it is. And if it's specifically in Russia, it halts any other malicious activity.
I certainly don't know where this comes from.
It then downloads content from an attacker-controlled URL based off the country code, uses a predefined embedded password to extract, decrypt, and execute those downloaded files. So one last layer of obfuscation in here, they actually pad the malware files using just a whole bunch of zeros to make them absolutely massive. Because most anti-malware engines and like VirusTotal specifically actually have a upper bounds on the file size that they can scan. For VirusTotal, with their public interface, you can only upload a 32 megabyte file. For a private interface, it's like 650 megabytes. The attacker in this case padded out their malicious executable to 750 megabytes, which is far larger than either of those two thresholds to theoretically evade detection. And finally, it gains persistence by creating a shortcut to the executable file and establishing a scheduled task that executes every day at 4 a.m. So, Corey, where do you think this malware was developed?
I don't know. There's no hints at all, Mark. They didn't want it to happen in Russia, so it was probably designed in the U.S., right? Based on current politics.
We're joking.
Russia.
So the reason they do this, by the way, is in general, Russia encourages their citizens to cause discourse like this around the world, as long as you don't impact Russian and like puppet Russian states. And so a lot of malware authors, and specifically in the ransomware space, will make sure they are specifically not in Russia before they execute. That way they can keep doing whatever they want while living for free in Russia without any consequences whatsoever, unless they try and step foot outside their country.
Yeah, that's a pretty solid sign that.
Great, great, great place. Yep. So anyways, on this topic, though, like yet another supply chain attack, and this one targeting specifically like gamers and developers or so. This isn't the first time we've seen Visual Basic files being leveraged like this, but it's interesting seeing attackers use effectively search engine optimization on their malware within GitHub or the repositories in GitHub to try and get it to give some credibility when someone's looking for the legitimate version of the app, trick them into getting the bad version.
It's smart. I mean, it's certainly not the first. It's funny how techniques that maybe could trickle from non-directly illegal. I immediately thought Amazon reviews, especially for certain countries' overseas projects, where literally companies or people will, storefronts will put something, a private store on Amazon, because you can do that. It's often not Amazon really sanctioning it. They're just hosting it. And they'll create a lot of fake Amazon accounts and make all kinds of five-star reviews for items. And of course, same thing on Amazon. You show up in the ratings. You think it's a great product. You get some junk from some unnamed country I won't mention, and it really is crap.
Canada.
So right? United States manufacturing, we've gone downhill, of course. I'm kidding. I'm sure everyone can guess. But anyways, I mean, that might be against EULA, but not super illegal, but it's really the same concept. And nowadays with social media and likes and stars and crowdsourcing reviews, it's trendy to crowdsource your data nowadays, but by definition, by crowdsourcing, you're allowing a big opportunity to poison results. So it's definitely interesting seeing them use kind of the crowdsourced GitHub star ratings to get things to show up. And it's interesting to see them holding back. Like you said, the fact that instead of spamming bazillion stars to these weird ass projects, everyone could figure out, wait a second, this can't have that many stars. Doing it in a subtle way is smart too.
Yeah. In terms of practical tips, like if you are a software developer or someone who dabbles in GitHub, like the stars and the search order ranking are factors you can use for credibility, but not the only factors you should use. Definitely take a look at the actual author themselves. Like other red flags would be brand new accounts hosting repositories just in general. You can take a look at who starred them and really just give a little bit of skepticism. The good news is like Visual Studio and VS Code, Microsoft's other kind of free development environment, they actually have some protections against this. When you open up one of these repositories or packages in your IDE, it'll actually give a little prompt window saying, do you trust this code? And nothing in there can execute unless you say yes. So maybe don't hit yes on there unless you're very, very certain that you should trust that code, in which case you're probably fine.
I would say another simple practical tip. While the stories weren't related, as you pointed out, the samples they're using all throughout this report, the actual GitHub that they're trying to get people to come to seems to be for a Valorant cheat again, Valorant cheat visual aimbot. So an aimbot. And I think during that week of the podcast, I mean, whatever you're doing on GitHub, there's anytime you're trying to download a DRM tool or a cheat bot for any sort of games, you know, we all like modding, we all like playing around sometimes, but you're getting into dangerous territory. It's very common for them to, you know, nothing is totally free. So if there is a free GitHub or a free GitHub offering a Valorant cheat bot, when there's places you have to go to buy those, the chances it might come with something else in it too. So as you're looking for trustworthy GitHub projects, I think it's important to consider the project type. This probably goes, by the way, there's lots of free hacking and pen testing and exploit tools on GitHub, and lots of them are legitimate, but I would also suggest those could be dangerous too. They're another great opportunity for someone to Trojan something in a free tool some security person is trying to get, unless you look at all the details of the code and what other additional things it's downloading.
Really feels like we're moving towards a point, and maybe we've probably already arrived there already and I'm just lazy, but moving towards a point where you really need to not just blindly accept these open source tools that we're using and do your own due diligence and review them before you actually start plugging them in or executing them. Yeah. As it seems too dang easy to compromise this part of the supply chain, unfortunately.
It's really easy to get code. And then I'm going down a rat hole in my brain. If more and more people start poisoning code on public repositories like GitHub, and then all our coding tools are specifically using that code for their machine learning algorithms to help people write code without knowing how to code themselves, what is that
We're
going
screwed.
To turn out?
Welcome to our horrible, distant, maybe not so distant looking future.
We'll figure it out. I say, not really believing myself.
We will, or AI will eliminate humanity and it won't be a problem either way.
There you go. Our classic ending to the 443 news section.
Just unplug everything and go live in a cave. You'll probably be happier. At least I would be. Hey everyone, thanks again for listening. As always, if you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. If you have any questions on today's topics or suggestions for future episode topics, you can reach out to us on Instagram at WatchGuard_technologies. Thanks again for listening. That will never get old. And you will hear from us next week. Bye.
Bye. Wow, saying it that way with the hearts is extra awkward.